Hey everybody, welcome to Creature Feature, the show where we examine the weirdest creatures and humans on the planet. I'm your host, Katie Golden. I studied psychology and evolutionary biology, and I'm certainly not a hive mind intelligence of every bird on the planet who are waiting to make their move for the grand avian revolution. Today we're talking about cryptids. What are they? Are they real? Are they right behind you? The truth behind Mothman, the Chupacabra, and Bigfoot, and what they don't want you to know. Who's they? I don't actually know. Discover this and more as we answer the age-old question, what slimy, terrible creature may be lurking right under your feet? So, why do we love cryptids? Cryptids are animals that people believe exist based on anecdotal evidence, rumors, myths, folktales, and conspiracy theories. There are cryptid sightings all over the world, in almost every culture. Why are they so compelling? I think the idea of secretive animals who elude our attempts to document them is a massively appealing one. It's the ultimate freedom to live in isolation, nimbly evading the watchful eyes of human society, only being caught in the blurry photos of conveniently terrible photographers. Maybe it's wish fulfillment fantasy. We live in a hyper-surveilled world, either in tight-knit communities who know everything about you, or vast metropolises with the details of your existence on file. Cryptids are an escape from society, monsters who are more revealing of our own psychological quirks. Well, at least that's the story the man would have you believe. What if I told you there are some real-life cryptids? Today we'll be looking at the facts behind the cryptids, what it would mean if they actually existed, and the real animals that are just as crazy as the cryptids themselves. Joining me today to discuss this is Tess Lynch from Night Call Podcast.
Hi Katie, how are you?
Great, I'm so excited to have you because I know you guys love to talk about conspiracy theories, and it's like all those late-night conversations that you have with your friends when, you know, you're winding down from the day, and then your mind goes to incredibly creative places.
It's really fun. And I was so excited that we're going to talk about cryptids because we've talked about cryptids on the podcast before, but also we're all Steely Dan fans. And of course, the squonk is memorialized by Steely Dan.
The squonk,
the cryptid, the squonk that cries.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
So my dad's a big Steely Dan fan.
He's
a Dan fan. Dad Dan fan.
Nice.
But I actually am not familiar with this, the squonk.
The squonk. There is a book that I feel like I talk about a lot and everyone's always like, okay, Tess. But it's called Fearsome Creatures of the North Lumberwoods, I think. It has like a kind of clunky title.
It's pretty specific. Yeah.
It is. Yeah. It's been out of print for a while, but they have these like kind of crude doodles. It's a very old book. Of all of these like different regional cryptids, and the Wendigo is probably like the most well known. But then the squonk is just a creature that's like a depressed cryptid, and
aww,
it wanders around weeping.
Aww.
Yeah, and so there's a Steely squonk. Dan song called "Any Major Dude Will Tell You," and it's like, "Have you seen a squonk's tears?"
Aww,
yeah,
squonk,
squonk.
That makes me sad.
I know.
So. First, we're going to talk about another cryptid that I think is kind of sympathetic. You know, like I think that's what's so cool about a lot of these cryptids. I mean, some of them are supposedly evil, but yeah, a lot of them are just like, they're kind of sympathetic in a way. Like, you kind of want to get to know them, you know, like Bigfoot. But first, we're going to talk about Mothman.
Oh, Mothman.
Yes. Just for those of you who may not know, Mothman is a cryptid originating from West Virginia. It started in 1966 when several gravediggers spotted a brown winged creature, too big to be any kind of bird. And later, a couple driving at night saw a huge creature with glowing red eyes, no neck, and wings folded against its back. The Point Pleasant Register, one of the local papers, reported, quote, "Couple sees man-sized bird, creature, something." And then ever since then, there have been sightings throughout the years. Some people believe that the Mothman pops up right before an oncoming tragedy or catastrophe. I really love this one. It's so creative. It's very, there's something kind of eerie. It's like not, because the Mothman doesn't necessarily hurt anyone, but it's just spooky.
It's just warning you.
Right, right.
Yeah, that the shit's going to
hit
the fan.
Bad omen. Yeah.
Yeah. I had never heard about the Mothman until obviously the Mothman prophecies.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm not sure how much of this, probably zero, is based on the actual legend. But yeah, I had no idea that it was like a human-sized necklace
yeah
thing. But I mean, you kind of wonder if there's like, you know, kind of like with near-death experiences and things like that, there are tend to be like similar threads. So it makes, I mean, if you just see like a kind of lumpy specter right before something terrible happens, it could be like an adrenaline response. But the red eyes are always a nice touch. Love a cryptid with the red glowing
those
eyes.
Those red glowing eyes. I actually get occasional sleep paralysis. And it's not really the hallucinating type. It's more of the menacing presence where something is sitting, something evil is sitting on my chest. So I feel like it's dictated by the kind of culture I consume. So if I am, I listen to a lot of like murder podcasts and stuff. So when I listen to those and I get sleep paralysis, it's like, oh, it's a murderer sitting on my chest. Like, but what's weird is I think the part of my brain that's responsible for scaring me is also asleep, whatever specific disorder is going on. So like, I'm like not afraid, but I'm completely convinced like I'm going to get killed by a serial killer. But I'm like, I'm disappointed, but I'm not scared. I'm like well, oh, man. Jesus, this sucks. So I feel like if I got sleep paralysis and I really absorbed the Mothman prophecies, I might see a Mothman and be like, ah, geez. What?
Oh, come shucks, on. The Mothman. Why do you think that is? Do you think it's just because you're so relaxed that you can't have that normal kind of like jolt?
Yeah, I think so. Like with a with sleep paralysis, your brain is normally when it comes out of REM, rapid eye movement sleep, there's sort of a process of like the different parts of the brain kind of essentially turning back on.
Right.
But like if your sleep is disturbed and like say your so the pons in your brain is, will stop sending signals to your spinal cord. So you that's why you're paralyzed and. But if other parts of your brain, like parts of the prefrontal cortex wake up or the occipital lobe, and that's for people who get the visual hallucinations, that'll start to give, you'll start to process the real world, but then it connects with, like your amygdala isn't fully operating at 100% and it's not communicating well with the prefrontal cortex. So I think in my case, for whatever reason, like the amygdala is not communicating well. And then it's like, so that fear response is just not there. It's like it's like when you see someone in your dream and you don't have the emotional connection to them, and it's really bizarre. So it's like that. It's like I'm emotionally distant from this feeling of doom, and it's very weird.
That's fascinating. Maybe that's a good thing. I mean, I guess
it's good for me. I know some people with sleep paralysis, it's extremely terrifying. So I'm pretty lucky. So I'm in terms of Mothman. What I think if it, like I'm trying to think of a real, like say this is real, right? Like what would a Mothman moth human hybrid be like? One thing I think that people that makes it really goofy is that it would be covered in these big flaky scales, just like because moths, you know how moths are dusty? Those are little microscopic scales that play a role in coloration, and it's also thought they might be sort of thermoregulation, so like insulating them and keeping or absorbing sunlight so they don't overheat or get too cold. And so if it's like a proportionally sized you know, moth wing, and then there's just like all this like flaky scales, like every time the moth like flies away, like this dust kind of,
they need to exfoliate. They need to baby foot themselves.
Right. Some get some Pert Plus. What's the anti-dandruff shampoo?
Head shoulder. Do they have, do you know if Mothman has antennas?
Yeah. So moths do have antenna, and they actually, they're very sensitive in that they can detect pheromones. So they are highly attuned to using their those little feathery antenna to pick up on the scents of females. And so it's kind of like that's another spooky thing. Maybe that's why, if say Mothman was real, that's why he could like detect natural disasters, because he could like smell danger coming.
He can pick up the fear.
That's right.
So fascinating. I'm super into moths. I've been a big moth fan for a long time, with the exception of the ones that go into your cabinets.
Oh, I hate the food. I'm there. I'm at the same thing. The bigger the moth, the better.
The better, yeah.
It's those tiny ones that are like almost flat, where it's like they go into your cabinets and eat your food and get on your clothes. I don't like those because those are pests. But every other moth,
every other moth is good. I grew up. I lived for a while in Connecticut. And they had, I think they're Luna moths, but the like giant,
the big
greenish
ones.
So
yeah,
pretty.
Yeah, they're beautiful. I was walking in a nature reserve in San Diego, and I think it's called a sphinx moth, and they're these huge moths that actually get confused with hummingbirds sometimes they're so big, and they drink nectar like hummingbirds, and their wing beak can be mistaken for like a hummingbird's hovering. And it like landed on me and refused to let go. Like I was having trouble prying it off, and I didn't want to hurt it, so I just like let it sit on me, and then it just stayed on me, and then eventually like I kind of got it off with like a leaf and put it in a little box, and then it just like it died the next day. So I think it was I think it was like on its deathbed, and it was just, it saw me as it like this child with brightly colored clothes, and like was like, yeah, I'll sit on this human.
If you listened closely, it might have been willing you its estate. You just missed it.
I leave to you this leaf and assorted poop. So there's a couple of compelling theories about like what the real animal is behind the Mothman sightings. So theory one is the sandhill crane. Arguments for it is that these are big birds. So they're grayish brown. So that brown color matches the description. They weigh up to 15 pounds, and they're a little over 4 feet in height, and they have a 7-foot wingspan. So it's reasonably large for a bird. You're not, like, if you're not used to these animals, that would seem too large to be a bird.
Yeah.
They also have red foreheads and orange eyes. Here's a picture of one looking particularly malevolent.
Oh, that is the Mothman. I'm convinced. Because they also look kind of mad.
Yeah, they do. They menacing. Look angry. Yeah. And that's just because their foreheads are fluffy. Their migration path takes them from Canada to Florida, and they pass through Kentucky, but they don't go through West Virginia, but they're close enough that in 1966, a wildlife biologist was saying, oh, this is probably a sandhill crane that was like veering off course. So the residents weren't used to these birds. So they were attributing the Mothman to this unfamiliar bird that was bigger than any bird that's like local to the area. Here's the problem, and this is the problem that a lot of conspiracy theorists point to, is that sandhill cranes, they got big necks. And Mothman, he don't got no neck.
He has no neck.
That picture I showed you, the reason that looks like the Mothman is because that his head is actually turned. So like when they're sleeping or resting, they fold their necks back and they like kind of rest it against their body. So it could be that, but if the sighting was like an agitated bird, I would imagine it wouldn't keep its neck like that. So
also, aren't cranes, I'm totally pulling this out of the air, I know nothing about cranes, but I would assume they wouldn't like approach people.
I mean, yeah, I'm not sure. Like it's, I don't think generally speaking they would be aggressive.
Yeah.
Like if this one's off course on its migration, it's already stressed out, maybe it was like aggressively flapping at some people.
Help.
But then if it's being aggressive, I would imagine its neck wouldn't be at rest. So.
Right.
But it's possible. Like, say it's like kind of just chilling out and these guys see it and it's really spooky, and they and then it like kind of stretches its wings out and they perceive that as being like, you know, aggressive.
Yeah.
Or like in the case of the couple who, there was like a couple who said that it followed them in their car. Maybe it was super lost and it was like, maybe.
You guys going to Florida?
Where are you guys heading? Florida? So theory number two is that it is an owl. Which sounds dumb because it's like, of course you know an owl is an owl. But here's some reasons it could be. One is that it's local to the area. And there's a species of owl called the barred owl that is in the specific region that these sightings happened. And their eyes actually, so different owls will have different eye shine. So barn owls, which were another candidate, they don't typically have red eye shine. So eye shine is when at night, like light reflects off the eye and you can actually see like the retina and the blood vessels. And that's why like in photos you have red eye.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when cats and other nocturnal animals, like you see those kind of glowing eyes. For the barn owl, their eyes don't shine red. So people are like, oh, it can't be an owl. But the barred owl, this is, I know it sounds similar, but it's barred, like B-A-R-R-E-D.
Okay.
Like an owl that.
Not like Shakespeare owl.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And it, their eyes do glow red at night because of the red eye shine, because they have these deep eyes with a lot of blood vessels that will refract that light back. And the initial descriptions of the Mothman were very owl-like, with the wings that were folded on the back, the head that blended into the rest of the body. As you know, owls kind of, they don't really have a neck. They do, but you can't see it.
Don't
They're
make them
fluffy.
Feel bad. Don't shame the owls.
I'm not neck shaming them. It's fine if they don't have neck. It doesn't seem like you would mistake
right.
an owl for a monster, though. But have you ever seen an owl without feathers?
No.
Owls, when they don't have feathers, are shocking looking.
Now, oh no. Or is it going to ruin owls forever
yes.
for me?
Oh,
oh no. Ah! Ah! What happened to those owls?
They're fine. But these are probably young owls that are growing their feathers. And they're probably a little scared, so that's why they're standing so tall. But this viral video went online because people thought they were aliens.
They look like aliens, but also you could totally see they look kind of like moths.
Yeah, they look humanoid, right?
Yeah.
So it's like these fledgling owls who don't have that many feathers. They're fluffier than in one way. Their feathers are more downy, kind of
yeah.
like wispy. But they're not fully filled out with the feathers, so you can see their legs are really long.
Mm-hmm.
That's another surprising thing about owls. They have mega legs, legs for days. Here's a picture of, it's an artistic rendering of an owl without feathers.
Wow, that is so wild.
Yeah, they look like aliens, right?
They do, yeah. Or like very old men.
Right, and here's a really funny one of someone showing how tall their legs are. It's just a person lifting the owl up, and so you can see how tall their
gams
are.
They're like two-thirds leg.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, do those legs go all the way up? And the owl's like, why, yes, indeed they do.
Why? Put me on the runway. I'll show you.
If you think about it, that makes sense, because raptors often have big, beefy legs because they have those huge talons, and they need that muscle power for grasping prey.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I think, surprising to people because owls are so fluffy, their feathers cover all that leg.
Yeah, it gives them like a totally different body shape.
Right, exactly.
But so, how big is the barred owl?
It's not that big, but I feel like it's big in terms of a bird.
Right.
The owls are, I think it's like about, it's like a couple feet tall.
Okay.
I think, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
There was a study that showed when people are like driving along the road at night, they have really poor perception of the size of things.
Yeah.
So if you're scared, also you'll perceive something as being bigger than it really is. And they have a pretty good wingspan. So if you can imagine, like, say a barred owl, either a young barred owl who hadn't fully, fledged, or like a one with like some hair loss or not hair loss,
a little pattern baldness.
Yeah. Some owl pattern baldness. Just kind of like being agitated and their hoots are also very like deep and somewhat foreboding. So I could definitely see that as being, you see this leggy creature with wings and no neck and glowing red eyes, and it's hooting maliciously at you. And you're like, yeah, that's a demon.
Right. Yeah. Something bad did just happen.
Yes.
It's not even telling me. It already happened.
That when an owl happens to you, that's bad enough. No, I love owls.
I love owls too. They can take it. We can rib
right,
owls.
Right.
It's fine.
Owls have a thick, thick feathery husk, and under that, a bunch of leg.
Yeah. Is Mothman just a mirror into the psychology of humanity? Maybe. David Gallo, a psychology professor at the University of Chicago, believes that Mothman sightings may be part of a sort of group culturally dictated cognition. He explains that certain cultural ideas can influence how your brain interprets stimuli. So maybe after the first Mothman sighting, every owl, bird, or blurry camera artifact became a Mothman. I think there's something pretty spooky about how we can almost create mass hallucinations just through the force of storytelling. In a way, that makes Mothman real, an apparition of collective imagination. When we return, we'll talk about more cryptids, starting with an infamous bloodsucker. So
why do we fear the bloodsucker? After all, vampires exist in almost every culture and over many centuries of folklore. One theory is that they're a manifestation of social upheaval. Vampire folklore seems to thrive in places where lower classes were persecuted. Nina Auerbach, University of Pennsylvania English professor and author of, quote, Our Vampires Ourselves, says vampire fears arise during times of strife, such as in Eastern Europe when peasants were persecuted, or perhaps in 1995 when farmers found that their precious livestock had been massacred. So, El Chupacabra literally translates to the goat sucker, I'm pretty sure. So it's actually more recent than I had thought. Like, I'm sure iterations of it existed before 1995, but...
95?
Yeah. But it really hit sort of popular culture in 1995. So it's a cryptid who is said to live on the American continent in Mexico, southwestern U.S., and in Puerto Rico, and in Central and South America. So the first reported attack occurred in 1995 in Puerto Rico, where 8 sheep were discovered with their blood sucked dry and puncture wounds in their chest. And so the distressed farmers, which for a farmer, when your livestock is killed, it's like, if like one sheep is killed by a wild animal, like that sucks. But if like 8 sheep are all killed and like just drained of their blood.
And then just
like,
left there.
And left there. Yeah. That's super upsetting. And so the sightings of the chupacabra typically describe a leathery gray beast with spines on its back. And it kind of looks like a cross between like in descriptions like a kangaroo, a lizard, and a hairless dog. So
nice, good combo.
Yeah, a lot of pictures of like chupacabras online tend to, there's actually ones that are like of, they're called Jolos, I think. It's got a longer name. It's like Jolos. Jolos. We'll call them Jolo
Let's
dogs.
Do Jolos.
Yeah, they're Mexican hairless dogs, and they're born without hair, perfectly healthy when they don't have hair. But they, I think they're pretty cool looking dogs. They kind of look like Anubis. I think they may even be called Anubis dogs. Mm-hmm. But they're really neat. But like we're not used to seeing a hairless dog, so sometimes people show a dog like that and be like, that's a chupacabra. It's
right.
Like, no, it's just a normal dog, but he bald.
he bald. But also the Mexican hairless dog, like the first association I have is the Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark story.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Where the couple goes to Mexico.
Oh, yeah.
And they're like, and everyone's like, look, you found a hairless dog. It's so cute. And then they come back to the U.S. and they're like, no, that's a rat with rabies. I was like, that does not really, the two don't resemble each other at all, but it's
like also it's not, it's like just anatomically a rat, because I've seen naked rats.
Oh, for sure.
Know,
yeah,
bald rats, they just look like bald rats.
Yeah, they do not look like dogs.
Yeah, you're really roasting Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
That's true. Unacceptable. Because that story also, it was like, it's not like scary so much as it just sucks. But,
they're just very dumb in this story.
Yeah, exactly. They're really dumb. And then they're just like, oh, I guess like we don't have the dog we thought we had. It's a story of like yuppie disappointment.
I think that's also like, little bit of the stuff of like things in Mexico are scary.
Exactly.
And weird.
You never know what's like going on in
Mexico. Like that weird yellow filter they put on film when it's like you when you go to Mexico, like it's all yellow filter and like that like weird like wiggly distortion
the
when things are hot.
Dust motes and stuff. Yeah.
Like when the ground is hot and it makes the air kind of distort around. It's like,
otherwise, how would you know?
Yeah, how would you know?
That you were in Mexico unless they made it a completely different universe.
Exactly. Yeah. I was wondering how like there could be a real chupacabra. So like a demonic goat sucking creature that manages to suck the blood out of sheep without them noticing. Maybe it could be like a leech or a vampire bat that's like a hybrid with a dog or something. So it's got the stealth and intelligence of a dog, and then the blood sucking abilities of a leech or a vampire bat. Now, leeches and vampire bats both have anticoagulant in their saliva that makes it easier for them to suck up blood. But one thing I found, and I had actually believed this myth before researching this, that that their saliva contains an anesthetic. That's actually not true.
Really?
There is no evidence of there being an anesthetic in their saliva. There's a morphine-like substance in their neural tissue. So it's confusing because there's still a possibility that maybe they're somehow secreting this in their bite, but there's no evidence that it's actually in their saliva or in their sort of mouth secretions that would make would numb people too. And I read some biologists who are like saying like it's a total myth that it doesn't hurt because it can hurt when a leech bites you.
I was always wondering about what it felt like to get a leech because growing up, like, you know, I would go swimming in shady,
right,
like the shady lake where it's like, who knows what's in there. And some of my family members would be like, look out for leeches. And some of them had leeches, but it was none of them could really remember because they just remembered being creeped out finding the leech, but they couldn't remember like a sensation.
Yeah.
And I always wondered if there was something that made it not hurt or like, you know, able to like ignore the sensation, or if it was just the suction was so, you know, pinpointed basically that can numb.
I think that's I think it's the latter. I think since their teeth are so tiny and needle-like, and you probably get it while you're swimming, so you're in cool water perhaps, and like you're maybe not noticing all of those body sensations as much. So that would be that. I suspect that would be the case. Like it's kind of like you wouldn't necessarily notice someone like poking you with a syringe underwater in cold water. But the anticoagulant is very real, and that makes it easier too. So it's not like they're actively like sucking like a vacuum.
Yeah.
They're just kind of allowing the blood flow to come into their mouth.
Right.
And vampire bats also have teeny tiny needle like teeth, which, you know, it's probably like the cow's like, whoa, what was that? But it doesn't necessarily disturb the cow because they're not like sucking on it. They're gently lapping at the wound. Yeah, but here's the thing. This is why the chupacabra, even if we invent this like dog vampire bat leech hybrid, it still wouldn't really work as an animal, because most vampiric animals, first of all, they don't necessarily kill their host. Otherwise, if they're capable of that, why wouldn't they just eat the rest of the host?
Yeah.
Also, they tend to be small. Like a vampire bat is little tiny cutie. And leeches, little tiny, not as cute, but still
cute.
Quite tiny.
Yeah.
mosquitoes, super tiny. These are all the animal, a lot, I mean, there are more than that, but most of the animals that tend to suck blood are small. And that's because something the size of a dog couldn't subsist on blood alone. Their body mass would be too great. They would need things like fatty tissues. So the real animal behind the myth of the chupacabra is probably, wait for it, mangy dogs and coyotes.
Bummer. What a letdown.
I know. So biologists think that the reports of chupacabras are likely stray dogs in Puerto Rico, where they do have a lot of stray dogs. And when the dogs are malnourished, they tend to get mange. Because they're less capable of fighting off these. So mange is caused by parasitic mites. So when you have a healthy dog, their immune system, their body is able to kind of fight off these parasites. But if they're malnourished, it's harder, and then they tend to get mange. And that explains the appearance of the chupacabra pretty aptly, because that gray leathery skin is probably mangy skin, because there's probably a lot of scabs, it's hairless. And it would also explain the spikes along the back, because if they're malnourished, this is really sad, but if they're malnourished, their vertebrae are probably sticking out, so those look like spines. And their faces probably look more angular and reptilian. And it would also explain why they potentially attack livestock, because if they're too weak to hunt down regular prey, they probably go where they typically are too afraid to go, but they're so hungry, they're like going after livestock. And they may not even know what to do with it at that point. They probably get easily spooked. If the rest of the livestock starts to make a fuss, then they might run off without even eating it. So that coyotes and dogs are known to do that, where they'll bite something, attack it, maybe with the intention of eating it, but then if they get spooked, they'll run off before they make this calculation. And I would imagine that a malnourished dog or coyote is worse at making that calculation. They don't know what necessarily to do once they've you know, killed a sheep, like they're like, okay. And then like there's a bunch of sheep around that are maybe jostling and angry, and then they get scared. And then that whole blood draining thing is actually potentially not true. So it's not that it's that a lie, like they're making it up. It's that it's a misconception. So veterinarians reviewed these livestock, and they actually found that they did have blood in them. It wasn't that they had been drained dry of blood. It's that what happens is that when any living animal dies that has blood in it, it's a process called lividity, where the blood pools at the bottom. So it's like if you cut it, like say you're doing like an autopsy on a dead sheep that's been dead for a while, it won't bleed. So a farmer who's used to slaughtering an animal that's, you know, either alive or like maybe freshly dead or something, mm-hmm. they would be used to blood flow when you like cut through the animal. So if it doesn't, they would very reasonably assume that it'd been drained of blood. And so I think that's probably the most likely explanation.
But if there were 8 of the sheep killed, would that be like a pack of?
Could have been. Yeah, it could be. Although, you know, it's something where, you know, it could be a dog just like going crazy, biting things, or a coyote. It could be a pack of them. Although I would assume if it was a pack, they would successfully take one down. But they could have gotten spooked. Like mm-hmm. they could have gotten spooked and run off. Yeah. And then subsequent sightings of it. Because I think the initial encounter, like they didn't necessarily see what happened. They just saw these dead sheep. So that could have been like a pack that like came in, tried to kill them, and then got spooked and ran off.
Yeah.
And or they were... This is more morbid, but maybe they were just having fun and killing for fun.
I don't know. Funny games. Oh, they God. Farmed it.
Funny coyote games. Yeah. But yeah, I think it's and then like maybe people like I was talking about these sort of cultural memes that happen where then you interpret things that you see as fitting in with other people's sort of rumors and stuff. So it's like you hear about this like thing, blood sucking creature, then you see like a mangy coyote and you're like, hey, maybe that's
right.
Especially one that's like in the area where another animal got killed, because this chupacabra, it's been in multiple areas, right? Puerto Rico, in Mexico, the Southwest in America, and like Central and South America. So it's like these multiple sightings, unlikely a new breed of animal that like, you know,
that looks like a reptile with spines on its back. I think that's a really good hypothesis. I mean, especially because here in LA, like, you know, in the past couple of years, I think especially during when the drought was really, really bad, you would see coyotes that were clearly like hardier than the coyotes you'd normally see, like coyotes where you would assume they would hunt far away from people, but that they're being driven kind of closer to people just based on lack of water, lack of resources. And some of them looked really rough, you know?
Well, so my parents' house in San Diego kind of neighbors an area of Chaparral. We would get a lot of coyotes. We even got a mountain lion in our backyard once. Man. And my parents' backyard is pretty friendly to these animals because it's like there's like a little wood fence, but there's the whole yard has a lot of trees and bushes and stuff. So it's like, all you know, very similar to kind of their native stuff on the other side of the fence. And so it's... they would love to come in. We had like coyote puppies that came in. But like, so a lot of times, like at night, you know, I'd hear coyotes and they sound like when they're in a pack, they have this weird, they almost sound like demonic children laughing.
Yeah. They have like it almost sounds like a baby crying or something. It's
like, and it's super creepy. I feel like there's something inherently creepy about coyotes. I mean, they're really cute too. Like the little puppies are adorable, but they're kind of menacing their whole pack structure where they kind of try to like they'll go in and sneakily kill your chickens or kill your livestock or even your pets. And that's creepy. And
especially the pack. I think the pack, my parents were out here and they were walking their dog in Griffith Park at night. And like my dad saw a coyote and then heard behind him like a rustling, and he was being surrounded by the pack.
That's so creepy. Yeah.
Yeah. And that was super scary. But even though, I mean, I love them. And like, I know it's clearly
you can be creeped out by something, but still love it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Do you have sanguivorophobia? That's a fear of vampires.
And if you have a fear of these blood-sucking demons, maybe you also have hemophobia, a fear of blood, or blood injection injury phobia, which covers a fear of blood, injections, or seeing a physical injury. These are extremely common phobias, which kind of makes sense. Losing blood is generally not good for us, nor is getting injured or poked with something. So these very normal reactions can spiral into a full-blown phobia. Often, people with these phobias also experience vasovagal syncope, meaning fainting. But fainting at the sight of blood doesn't necessarily mean you're a fraidy cat. In fact, vasovagal syncope may have deep evolutionary roots. Our animal ancestors also experienced fear bradycardia, which means a slowing of the heart in response to stress. Bradycardia can lead to fainting both in animals and humans. This may be an evolutionary defensive mechanism when the heart is in peril, either due to injury or stress. A paper by Alboni et al. Called Origin and Evolution of Vasovagal Syncope says, quote, "The slowing of heart rate induced by the vasovagal reflex may constitute a beneficial break of cardiac pump, thereby reducing myocardial oxygen consumption." Basically, it's giving your heart a chance to rest. Unfortunately, this means the rest of you might take a very sudden and unexpected rest as well, resulting in, well, fainting. So grab your fainting couch. When we return, we'll talk about some very real, very creepy cryptids. So cryptids all over the world have similar features, which maybe speaks to some deep instinctive human fears. Take for instance the fear of giant worms. There's the Minho Cow, a Brazilian legendary giant worm, a man-sized Mongolian death worm, the 1990s movie Tremors starring Kevin Bacon, and many other giant worms in folklore around the world. Maybe we have an instinctive fear of these slithery creatures. They're snake-like, they can be parasites, and they're associated with death and decay in the deep, deep underground. Well, good thing these giant, crawly, slimy worms are just legend. Oh, I'm sorry, did you forget which podcast you're listening to? Of course they're real! So, the giant Gippsland earthworm, native to, of course, Australia, is a 3-foot-long worm, and depending on how long it's stretched or how much it's contracted, it can be about the thickness of a medium to large-sized rope. They live in deep burrows in Gippsland, Victoria. They actually have really long lifespans. They live for several years, and they only reach sexual maturity at 5 years. Typically, they're never seen on land, as they spend their whole lives deep, deep in their muddy burrows. While on land, they can't move too fast. Inside their special wormholes, they can slip and slide around pretty rapidly. In fact, they make a deep, guttural, gurgling sound, like water draining from a bathtub as they scoot through their holes, which can terrify people because you can hear it from the surface.
I hate this. That's the worst thing I've ever heard.
Which, it makes sense that people would be scared of that.
Yeah.
That, like, sort of deep in the earth kind of thing, and, like, just sort of sliding around in this mud.
Slipping and,
like,
and sliding slipping in the mud. Slipping and
sliding. There's this famous Japanese comic by, I think it's Junji Ito, that where it's like about people who there's like these holes in a cliff face that are people shaped, and then people like crawl in the holes and they just like get sucked in, and it's super creepy. And I just imagine that noise, like these giant
and watching it is also unpleasant. I mean, I actually really like worms, but not this worm. I don't like it.
This worm's pretty big. It's a hefty. It's a big boy.
It's a thick worm.
It's a thick. So we like to call them big ol' noodle boys.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about another very real cryptid, but perhaps in a way you might not expect. So Bigfoot or Sasquatch is maybe the most famous cryptid in the world. It's found in North America, but North America is not the only place with a Bigfoot. So There's the Baramano of northern Pakistan and Afghanistan that locals describe as a humanoid ape-like creature who abducts women to mate with. There's the Bukit Timah Monkey Man, who is said to inhabit Singapore, which is a 3 to 6 foot tall, small difference, yeah. But depending on reports, it's an immortal bipedal hominid. And actually, biologists think sightings of this are the crab-eating macaque, but when I've seen, like, these macaques, they're, like, clearly small monkeys.
Yeah, so. They're small.
Yeah. There's the Maricoxi, which is a large ape-like creature in South American jungles who, these are more advanced versions of Bigfoot where they actually can use bow and arrows, which I feel like Bigfoot...
That's not fair.
No, I know, right? It's like Bigfoot, to me, has always been sort of a nice, like, passive guy, but you give, yeah. give Bigfoot, like, an AK-47.
No, you can't arm Bigfoot.
Don't arm Bigfoot. Yeah. Keep arms away from Bigfoot, please. We need legislation.
Yeah.
There's the... A Mogollon monster, which is a bipedal humanoid over 7 feet tall who lives in Arizona, who smells like dead fish or the musk of a snapping turtle with wild red eyes.
Ooh la la.
It's really interesting to me that so many cultures have a Bigfoot. And I'm kind of just speculating on why. Some of my theories are that it's like we have a kind of uncanny valley fear of apes.
Yeah.
Because they're almost humans. They look so close to humans, but they're just not. And so it's like I think that the uncanny valley is that description of that graph of your like comfort level when you look at like robots or a humanoid CGI thing. And as it gets more and more real, like your comfort level is like fine, maybe even goes up a little, but then like as it gets super close to being realistic, but not quite, the your comfort and anxiety like your comfort goes way down and dips into the uncanny valley, and then it goes back up as we get to like basically real human face.
It seems like it's almost a defense against getting tricked.
Yeah.
You know?
It's interesting, yeah.
It's super interesting. I remember like when I first heard about the uncanny valley and I was like, this is like a place I like to be. This is the creepy zone.
I love looking at like weird animatronics. I really enjoy the uncanny valley.
Me too. It's fun. Yeah, it's a fun place to be. Because it's like, it doesn't really make sense why it feels so spooky.
It's like going on a roller coaster, but it's happening inside your amygdala.
Yeah, yeah. But also like when you were talking about our complicated relationship to apes, I think it also has to do with how guilty we feel. Mm. I mean, I took my kids to the zoo like last year. I think it was part of a field trip. And we spent a long time like with the apes and they were taking care of their children and we were watching them from behind glass. And like when we saw the chimps, they were like coming up to the glass and interacting. And you just get this sense of how wrong this is, like how closely like you feel like it could be swapped the positions. And so sometimes I wonder about with Bigfoot if it's like we're kind of projecting the
we want there to be like a secret society of Bigfeet because it's almost like then maybe we haven't completely raised the entire planet. Like maybe there are secret pockets of just untamed wilderness, and I think that's super appealing. I think, that makes a lot of sense to me because I think with a lot of other animals, especially like less human looking animals, we can kind of like go like, okay, but they're just animals. But with apes, it's almost like looking into a mirror.
Yes, so exactly.
It's super that idea of like, oh, yeah, maybe animals can feel things.
Right. Yeah.
Whoops. Yeah. I also think that we tend to anthropomorphized thing like on the other end of the scale where it's like so when you see like faces in the clouds or like in tiles with like random patterns and stuff, it's called pareidolia, and that's kind of a your brain really wants to see that human face schema, and it's we develop it really early on. So like little babies start to develop the face schema, and they actually respond to like, say you make like a face where you put the eyes and the mouth in the right place and you hold it up to a baby and they're like, they can recognize that. And then if you like, you know, make it kind of like more bizarre, like the proportions off, they don't like that
as much. Take that away.
No.
I didn't order
this. You're no, thank you. I will not like to see the new Sonic movie. Right. Thanks. I almost wonder if like we experience this like pareidolia when we're looking at say, like a bear in the distance. And mm-hmm. sometimes bears can walk on their hind legs. Like they're capable of it. They don't, that's not their normal mode of locomotion. But if you see a bear on its hind legs, like from a distance, I could see, like, you know, you kind of project like a human face onto it.
Totally.
Because it's like, that's in human position. So like maybe that's because a lot of the I think a lot of the samples sent in to labs and stuff of like this is Bigfoot fur and stuff tends to be like bears.
Right.
Or deer, too.
Deer, that's interesting.
I think it's because like people will see like a chunk of fur somewhere and it's like maybe this is Bigfoot, but it's just deer.
It's not Bigfoot, guys.
Good news. There is a real world Bigfoot, a scientifically verifiable Bigfoot. It's called Gigantopithecus blackie, which is extinct. Sorry.
Oh, man.
Gigantopithecus is a species of prehistoric ape that lived from 9 million years ago to maybe about 100,000 years ago. We're not sure. There's very limited fossil evidence. All of the fossils we've found have been in South China and Vietnam. But we have just enough fossils to know what they looked like. So they were 9 feet tall and up to 1,300 pounds.
What?
Yeah, so we have their mandibles and jaws, and based on the size of their mandibles, which means we know what their skull size is, we know how big they had to be to support such a big skull, and like also their closest living relatives, orangutans, and we just use that anatomy to kind of build this animal up, and it's enormous.
That's like the weight of a horse.
Yeah, it's for comparison, gorillas only weigh up to about 430 pounds.
Gah!
So yeah, it's like the size of a bear.
That is wild.
Yeah. We know how big they were. We know that they were hominids, and we know that some of their closest relatives are the orangutans, which they're actually they're like 8 times the size of orangutans. But we don't know how they walked. So most paleontologists and biologists assume that they must have walked on all fours, because with such a massive body, that's hard to imagine being able to support that weight. But the argument for them being bipedal is that the shape of the jawbone, which is like this U shape, mm-hmm. Would allow for the windpipe to go traverse through the jaw. So like in, if you look at the anatomy of like, say, a gorilla that is walks on all fours, their skull is like forward and then their spine kind of forms this slope. So their trachea and their windpipe actually goes like not through the jaw, but like kind of behind it.
Uh-huh.
But for us, like if you feel your trachea, it's like it's right through that that little U shape of mm-hmm. your jawbone. And that allows our heads to sit erect on our spines. So there's that argument that like, well, maybe because their jaws are kind of U shaped. Of course, we have very little fossil evidence. So my personal feeling, as much as I want them to be bipedal, I feel like they probably at most would kind of walk slumped over with like kind of maybe one foot on the ground, maybe like 3 legs, maybe 4 legs sometimes bipedal, like maybe that jaw design and their skull design allowed them to stand up for longer periods of time. It's just such a massive animal. I can't imagine it being able to just stroll around like
hey,
walk
there,
it over
guys.
To this tree.
Well, what did it eat? Do we know what it ate?
We actually have a pretty good idea of what it ate based on fossil records of sort of the plant leavings in the teeth and mm-hmm. like the scraping marks. So it's thought that they ate bamboo, seeds, and fruit. So, you know, hippies.
Yeah.
Which I think is great because they're so huge that they probably had no natural predators, but they were just like these hippies hanging
vegans
hanging out, eating bamboo, seeds, and fruit. Now, they could have eaten more of an omnivorous diet, and we wouldn't know because we don't have the fossil records of
right.
it. But we do know they at least ate bamboo.
I love these guys. How come I never heard of this?
I think it's just because there's not a full skeleton of them. So it's like a fragment of a jawbone. Why is that interesting?
Right.
But when you really build it up from that, it's like this is an amazing animal. the reason it probably went extinct is, wait for it, climate change.
Oh, whoops.
Man. So the climate change was turning its forests into savanna. And since it was so large, it couldn't really adapt to the more meager food offerings. So smaller primates were able to go, okay, like our normal fruits and stuff are gone, but hey, we can still do this other stuff.
Yeah.
But like with such a big animal, it's sort of like how pandas, if you take away their bamboo, they can't survive as a species.
Yeah.
And which is interesting because like the Gigantopithecus also ate bamboo. It's to me kind of... it's very prescient. I mean, like last week we talked about the Amazon rainforest and climate change and like, you know, sure, we're not the size of the Gigantopithecus, but our society really yeah. is. We are a huge, huge society with so many people and we have such a high need for food and land. And
we're
stuff.
The vampires now.
That I don't know if we could adapt to a planet that gets downgraded to not necessarily being as human friendly.
Yeah.
So, you know, but, you know, maybe in like a few million years, like the next smaller iteration of humans will look at our skulls and be like, I wonder if they walked on like 2 feet or three
right.
feet, you know, like.
They were all vegans, clearly, like they yeah. should have been.
They were very against something called straws.
Oh, the straws.
Yeah. But that's an incredible story to me. It's like, hey guys, Bigfoot was real. I mean, they're
yeah.
dead,
yeah.
but it was real.
But once upon a time, I wonder like how that kind of came into play and like influencing Bigfoot, the legend.
I think it helps propagate it. I don't think it starts it, but I think when people hear about this, they're like, okay, an animal like this is possible.
So it's not impossible.
It's not impossible, which I mean, there's a certain logic to that. I just personally think that, well, when we do find species that we think have been extinct but actually aren't, it's usually in places that are really hard to explore. So there was a tree kangaroo found, I think, in Indonesia in an area that was extremely remote, very difficult to explore. And that was a case of a pretty large animal mm-hmm. that we thought had gone. It's not like huge. A tree kangaroo is about the size of a, you know, medium to large sized dog. But like it's... you know, it's a fairly meaty animal. It's unlike like when a really small animal we think goes extinct and then it's like, oh, but we found this insect over here. Like that kind of makes more sense. But with a tree kangaroo, it's like, oh, that's really exciting.
Right.
It's a specific species of tree kangaroo too. Not all. We knew like other tree kangaroos were still around, but it's still really exciting. But in that case, it's like they're either really deep in the sea, like coelacanths
yeah.
are these deep sea fish that are kind of this like evolutionary throwback that are like millions of years old. And like,
and they look it.
They do.
They really look old.
I'm sorry to say, but they don't look great for them.
No, they don't. They don't. They need a little lift.
Right. But, you know, they're deep, deep in the sea. So that's why we didn't realize they're still around. So like the idea that like some extinct Gigantopithecus is just chilling out in the Appalachia. I don't know.
I want to believe.
I
want to
believe
don't
too.
Believe.
I really, I'd be so pumped if it
right?
was real. I would be so psyched.
Just but the sheer size yeah. is like exciting.
But maybe we could scrape off some of that DNA from the jaw.
Clone it. Jurassic
exactly.
Park.
So before we go, you said there was a news item and I
oh,
want to hear
yes.
it.
Oh, yes. Okay. So my friend Dan Hernandez, who has guested on Night Call before with all of his cryptid knowledge, his dad was like a cryptozoologist.
Really cool.
It was so cool. Yeah. I was like, damn, I thought my dad was cool, but this is a very cool dad. But he just sent us this link to, I think I'm going to actually find out what the website is called. It's like it's a cryptozoology. Cryptomundo.
Nice.
Very festive name.
That is festive.
Cryptomundo. But it was this article about a cryptid called the Awful.
Mm.
And it was described as looking like a griffin, kind of, with a long serpent's tail, wings that were, I think, 10 feet each.
Wow.
And it would grab prey in its talons.
Right.
And so people reported that someone had seen it and they thought it was holding like a crying baby in its
talons.
Oh,
okay. That's
but
no
then
good.
Later they were like, maybe it was just a she.
Maybe
I think
it was
the
a
article,
baby doll?
Yeah. Maybe one of the, a baby alive.
Baby alive.
But I think it was first discovered in 1925 and H.P. Lovecraft was in Vermont, I think visiting friends. And he heard people talking about this thing. And he said that from the way that they talked about it and their responses to it, he kind of believed it was real. And I think it was one guy saw this thing, had a heart attack, like on the spot, had to be carried home. And I, in 1925 fashion, they're like, and then he was carried home and like, and he recovered.
Where was the sightings?
Woods of Vermont.
I see. Interesting.
Yeah. But then this article that was on Crypto Mundo cited a newspaper article from 2006 where a reader had written in, I guess, and said, I saw this. Everyone will think I'm crazy, so I want to be anonymous, but I've seen one and I think they're real. Like, I'm usually a pretty skeptical person, but I believe this thing is real, and it's called the Awful.
Huh. I mean, there were real animals that existed that were like this, the pterosaurs, so that's like pterodactyl, that's like the Quetzalcoatlus, that's the giant one that's like the size of a giraffe that was thought to be able to fly.
Wow.
But I wonder if like these sightings, I don't know, this is just throwing it out there. And of course, I'm not sure exactly where these sightings are, if this makes sense, but if it's like some kind of hawk that has caught a snake, because like,
and that would look predatory, like a tail.
Yeah. So predatory birds do prey on snakes, and sometimes they actually wrestle in the sky. And so it's like, I wonder if someone could see that and be like, that's a big flying animal with
and
a
that
tail.
Would mess with you for a long time, because it is like a strange thing to see, like the actual act you're of a hawk wrestling with a snake.
And if you're not expecting that, if you don't know about like hawks preying on snakes and you see that, that's got like, and then you have this kind of cultural understanding of like a griffin or like a monster, it's like that image will be interpreted by your brain as being like a griffin monster.
Yep. Yeah, that's actually a really good call, because I initially thought a turkey vulture.
Oh yeah.
Because I know that they kind of kick around up there and they're huge. Yes, like especially I think maybe just the way that they fly, it's very like dramatic looking, and they look big. But yeah, doesn't explain the tail.
Well, but they could be, it could be a turkey vulture holding like a dead lizard.
And especially if it were like a lot, but I guess like a lizard in Vermont, like what kind of lizards do they even have?
I mean,
there?
They do have snakes, right?
Yeah. Snakes, yeah. Yeah. And honestly, I think maybe like the giant eastern salamander might be up there.
Interesting, yeah.
Those are huge and like strange looking.
Do you think a turkey vulture could pick one of those up?
I've seen some really big turkey vultures. Yeah. I looked on, that was like my first thought was that it must be a turkey vulture. And then, but I mean, just like you said, when you see an animal that it kind of like startles you in your mind, it's just, you automatically make it bigger than it is. So in my mind, I was like, turkey vulture, sure. Well, like 15 foot wingspans.
And I mean, this has happened to me. So like when I was out walking my dog once and I saw this thing with glowing bright yellow eyes, and it was standing like a humanoid, and it was like this furry thing that looked, it was like, it, I was just like, my brain was like, monster.
Yeah.
And it didn't help that my dog was like growling at it, because I was like, oh my god, it is a monster. It's like, oh my god, monsters are real. There was that moment where I was like, holy crap, like demons and monsters are real, because here's one like standing in front of me on its hind legs. And then it like and it was like kind of making a weird noise, like and it was like really freaking me out. And then it looked huge to me, and it got on its all fours. It was a skunk.
No, you're kidding.
Yeah, it was just a skunk that was like on its hind legs for some reason, probably, you know, trying to scope me out, because it's like, who is this person and her very angry little tiny dog?
Right.
And the reason it looks so big, first of all, skunks can appear quite big because they're very fluffy.
And they can kind of puff up, right?
Yeah, they puff up. And it was on an incline. So in my brain, I shortened the distance between us because it was so scary. So it looked like, I thought it was human-sized. And then I realized, no, it's a skunk and it's normal skunk size. But it really, like if I hadn't gotten that verification that it was a skunk when it like flopped down on its fours and I saw that little white stripe, I may have like been like, yeah, I saw a Bigfoot.
Yeah. Total Sasquatch situation.
And then like, especially at night, and everything's creepy, and like when your clothes piled in the corner of your room at night look like some kind of evil demon, like with giant teeth, and it's like a shirt that's folded weird.
Yep. Not that that's ever happened to me.
Of course
my
not.
My not messy house. I think you kind of like hit the nail on the head when you talk about how we're so surveilled, and like we're there's nowhere to hide, you know, and also like so much knowledge is available to us and we have so little privacy that I think there is something of wanting to believe in animals that are so elusive and, you know, kind of leading the existence that we used to have more access to.
I mean, one thing I think that should reassure people is there are so many species of animals that we have not discovered that exist deep under the water. And I mean, even in forests and in rainforests, especially because of the huge amount of biodiversity. And I think it's that megafauna, which are like something like a Bigfoot. It's like a big cat that's like a cougar or something, the mammoths. Those are harder to really, like, you know, we've sort of run out of megafauna to discover. And I think that those big, magnificent animals that too often go extinct, you know, that's sad. And I think we want there to be secret, like these big, secret, cool animals like the Loch Ness Monster and the Bigfoot. And I want that too. I'm skeptical.
Now we just have to clone them. It's the only way.
We do have to clone them. Let's clone a Gigantopithecus and then we got a Bigfoot. And he's going to be super chill.
Yeah.
What if he's like
super... Of course he's chill.
What if he's like super annoying? He's always like bogarting all the weed.
He does sound like a frat guy. I was like, maybe people are just seeing like really confused, stoned frat guys. Right. And like, that's a Bigfoot. Like, yes.
Yeah, that's very Encino Man.
Right? Yeah, exactly.
Well, so you got anything to plug? You want to tell people a little bit about the podcast and where they can find it?
Yeah. So we're our podcast, Night Call. It's me and my friends Molly Lambert and Emily Yoshida. We do the podcast once a week. We took a little bit of a hiatus because we were moving networks over to iHeartMedia. And we're so excited to be doing it here. So, look out for Night Call. We talk about all things related to late night thoughts. So conspiracies, weird animals, outer space, psychic stuff, advice. Also, if you want to call with a question or a late night thought, you can give us a call at 240-46-NIGHT because we take calls, leave a voicemail, and we answer them on the air.
I might just call you guys.
Please do. We would love it.
It's going to be 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm like... Do you think bees are planning something?
Oh, that's exactly our jam. Yeah.
Can people find you on social media?
Yes. So we are Night Call Podcast on Facebook and Instagram and Night Call Pod on Twitter.
Awesome. And you can find us on the internet, creaturefeaturepod.com, creaturefeaturepod on Instagram, creaturefeetpod on Twitter, F-E-A-T, not F-E-E-T. That's very different. You can find me. I'm at Katie Golden on Twitter, and I'm also at Pro Bird Rights, where I am definitely the human, and it's not the bird controlling me. That's absurd.
Shh, don't tell.
And thanks to the Space Cossacks for their awesome song, Exolumina.